Divyastra is the theme of today's Cut the Clutter. It gives us a break from politics. This is the heavy political season. In the middle of this, while the Prime Minister is today watching the firepower demonstration of armed forces, this is the backdrop to this has come from the successful test of Agni 5. Now, Agni 5 is a missile that is it's an intermediate range missile which has been in service with Indian Armed Forces. So what's new with this one? This Agni 5 is the longest range yet, definitely 5,000 kilometers plus. Now, what happens with range is that as ranges are defined, once you go above 5,500, up to 5,500 is intermediate range ballistic missile. Once you go above 5,500, credibly, it becomes like an ICBM. An ICBM does not have to be 12,000 kilometers. Anything beyond 5,500. So Agni 5, the basic missile, which was tested successfully in 2012, that is 12 years ago, has definitely been in service for at least 2 to 3 years, most likely 3 years already. This version, one, it is the most advanced version. Also, it has done the longest distance. It has the longest range. Definitely in the 5,000 to 5,500 kilometer ballpark. That's why the note to airmen and marines, NOTAM as it's called, that India issued before this test in the Bay of Bengal, that covered a very wide region and very long distance. So that itself gave us an idea of how significant this is in terms of range. In fact, strategic affairs expert Brahma Chalani, who we know very well, he had tweeted when this NOTAM was issued, underlining the significance of this test. Please see that tweet on your screens. Now, the other distinctive thing or new thing about this version of Agni. Agni has been there for more than 3 decades now. The first version was tested more than 3 decades ago, and I will give you a listing of all that as we go along. But the difference this time is that this is an Agni with a MIRVING capability. MIRVING, we explained to you yesterday also, MIRVING is multiple independently targeted re-entry vehicles. Multiple like 5 warheads going up, independently targeted. So each one can go to different target and re-entry because these come back. So like all ballistic missiles, they go up, exit the atmosphere, then make an entry back. That's why re-entry. So easy to understand. Also, MIRVING technology is not new. In fact, the Americans first successfully tested and then deployed. They carried out testing in late 60s. They deployed the first MIRVING missiles in 1970. By 1971, they had also deployed a satellite-launched MIRVING ballistic missile. So these technologies are not new. But remember, very few countries have these technologies because those that have these technologies, then they go the extra mile to deny it to all of the rest. Now, many countries in the world have nuclear weapons capability informally as well. The Israelis have it. We don't know what the Israelis have by way of missiles. The North Koreans have it. They have pretty good missiles and a lot. And how good those missiles are, you can see every time the Pakistanis carry out a test, because at least on the Indian side, we watch Pakistan's tests much more closely, or India can watch Pakistan's tests much more closely than North Korea's tests. But whatever North Korea has, at some point, India has to presume the Pakistanis will also have, because that is China's way of keeping the balance between India and Pakistan, keeping India triangulated with Pakistan. Nevertheless, this is our first MIRVING missile. This is the first MIRVING missile. We don't know how many warheads it had. Now, there are some statements from sources in DRDO. I also read something that Dr. V.K. Saraswat, former head of DRDO, then member of Niti Aayog, also somebody who's featured on Walk the Talk long past when he used to be the head of DRDO. In fact, we recorded with him in the DRDO complex in Delhi, in the DRDO headquarters. He's indicated that this could be a bunch of warheads without exactly naming the number, but not a large number, not like 10 or a dozen, that some of the MIRVING ICBMs of America, Russia, America, as I told you, started in 1970. They deployed an SLBM in 1971, Merving SLBM in 1971. By the end of the 70s, the Soviets had matched up, and in the course of time, the Chinese also eventually did. And the Pakistanis claimed last October with a test, of a missile that they called Ababil. Ababil actually is a Quranic mythical bird, which is supposed to have come in to defend the Kaaba in 570 AD, the year the Prophet was born. That year, Kaaba apparently was under attack by a ruler, by a local ruler who had an army that included an elephant cavalry, right? In the Arabia, an elephant cavalry, but that's how the story goes. And he was coming in to destroy the Kaaba when these mythical birds emerged from nowhere and started hitting those elephants and that army with raining on them deadly stones, and so defeated the army. So Ababil is the name that the Pakistanis have chosen for their version of what they called as a Merving missile. However, as you would expect, the range of that missile is much shorter. Pakistani sites only go as far as the most distant parts of India. They want to cover every part of India. And once again, the Pakistanis don't have to research on their missiles very much. They get them. In the past, they got those from China, the first ones they got from China. And since then, China has made sure through Milibhagat that North Koreans keep transferring to Pakistan whatever the Pakistanis need. So they pretty much keep abreast of India. However, India's burden in this case, or India's concern in this case, is not so much Pakistan. Pakistan, if you really wanted to send them compliments on a nuclear, return on a nuclear weapon, you could send them by maybe by DHL, or maybe you could have them delivered by Dunzo or Zomato or something. It's so close by, I'm exaggerating and using facetious language. But the fact is that everything in Pakistan is available within a short range from India. Even the Prithvi kind of range will hit almost everything that matters in Pakistan. So that is not the issue. India's attention has to be on China. Because remember, what's a nuclear weapon? A nuclear weapon is the weapon of the losing side. No matter what you say, India has a no first use pledge, which means unless somebody uses a weapon of mass destruction against us, we will not use it. It's a written and declared no first use policy. But at the same time, it says that if somebody uses weapons of mass destruction on us, which is not confined, that definition is not confined to nuclear weapons, can be biological weapons, can be chemical weapons, then India's response will be massive and disproportionate. You can't think that I land one punch and the other side will land one punch or two punches. The other side, in this case India, says we will then destroy you. We'll hit you with everything we've got. It's for that situation that India needs a Merving kind of missile, because once you get into this race, you cannot draw the line and you say, I have enough. Now, on numbers, there's been a debate. And that debate was led by Dr. K. Subramaniam, the father of our current External Affairs Minister, and General Sundarji, a former Army Chief, who used to say more is not necessary when less is enough. That with nuclear weapons, you don't necessarily need so many hundreds, because even if you can land a few, that's good enough. But at the same time, the few that you have to be credible, have to be trustworthy, that if you fire one, it will actually go and detonate. You can't have a nuclear weapon that goes a dud. It will hit the target. It has to be accurate. Then it should be credible. Your deterrence has to be credible in the sense that it's spread out. Your adversary cannot hit and take out your nuclear assets first. And when you say spread out, then you have to be spreading it out in air, spreading it out on the ground in various parts of the country, in secure places, underground or otherwise. Have it on airborne platforms, aircraft, and also have it at sea, essentially in submarines. That is called the triad of nuclear deterrence. And that is what India has been working on. And that's why you see stories occasionally of this project being implemented in Vizag, where the new submarines, which will become India's active SSBNs, nuclear weapon carrying submarines, not just nuclear powered submarines, but nuclear weapon carrying nuclear powered submarines, the Sagarika project, that's going on there. this missile test fits into that larger picture. So this missile, what is it that's new about this missile? One, I told you the range. It's about 5,500, 600. It can be extended, I believe, to 7,000. We don't know about that, as much about that. But no adversary will take it lightly. No adversary will not work on the presumption that this missile has that kind of range. And that would mean that every part of China will be covered by this missile being fired from almost anywhere in India. Now, it's not something that you're looking forward to doing. Nobody is looking forward to using a nuclear weapon system. At the same time, for a deterrence to be effective, it has to look like something that you could really use. And if you used it, it will be really effective. Otherwise, a deterrent doesn't work. So how did this journey start? How did India's missile journey start? I might have had the privilege of having covered the first months, even the first years of it. So 1983, July 26, 1983 is when the Integrated Guided Missile Development Program was launched. Then the Dadas of DRDO and Defense Research were there, based Arunachalam. Dr. Kalam was then chosen to head this project. He wasn't the senior most in the system at that point. Dr. V.S. Arunachalam, who recently passed away, he was the head of DRDO and also scientific advisor to Raksha Mantri at that point. And that's when this program was visualized. India started working on missiles much earlier. In 1958, for example, Snesh Alex Philip tells me, DRDO set up a team called SWDT, SWDT as in Special Weapon Development Team. That then morphed into DRDL, and it was then located at Defense Science Center in Delhi, sort of in North Delhi. You can see it if you're driving past on GT Road towards, say, Haryana and Punjab. You can see on the left, there is a big Defense Science Center. From there, it shifted to Hyderabad in 1962. That's where I first ended up visiting the lab in 1984, if I remember correctly, while I worked for India Today. And that's when you saw the models of Prithvi and others being worked at. And that's where there was a larger model of something called Agni, or something that became Agni. So these missiles were visualized around that time. In 1972 also, because the idea of missiles was always there. And the fact is that Pakistan had beaten India in the basic missile race in the subcontinent. In 1965 war, Pakistan aircraft, fighter aircraft, had air-to-air missiles. India still had its first MiG squadron forming up. I think only 9 aircraft had come. So they had some kind of missiles, but early era missiles and not yet operational. Pakistanis, on the other hand, their F-104 starfighters, F-86 Sabres, they were fully missile capable. Even anti-tank missiles the Pakistanis got first. India at that point had a disadvantage because India did not have a Western source of this weaponry. And with the Soviet Union, Indian relationship only built up post the 1965 war. The MiG agreement was signed earlier, but larger supplies started coming in only from late 1960s onwards. So in 1972, DRDO set up another project called Project Devil. And that was to develop surface-to-surface missiles, because by that time, the big powers were already deploying MIRVing intercontinental ballistic missiles. For us, for my generation, that is the stuff that we saw in movies, and that is the stuff we read about in sort of Cold War era thrillers. There was a genre like that, and it was quite exciting. The only thing is, you never imagine that your country could be doing some of this. Now, because of these early efforts, that is SWDT and Project Devil, some basic facilities had been built up at the lab in Hyderabad. Basic facilities, test beds, fuel research, etc. That had been done. So by the time IGMDP, or Integrated Guided Missile Development Program, was instituted in 1983, a lot of the basic samagri was available. So the first success of this program was the Prithvi, which was just about 150 to 500 kilometers. The initial ones, liquid fuel, very cumbersome to carry. But even then, Dr. Kalam said, and I think it's quoted somewhere in one of my India Today stories, he said, this is the most accurate missile you can get in this range for love or money, right? So that missile came in. India had its, lo and behold, India had its first ballistic missile, something that India could not have imagined. Now, you can always say that Pakistan always stayed ahead, but that's because Pakistan had a source, in that case China, which was quite willing to cut the corners on nuclear proliferation as well as missile proliferation. Although there are international treaties on both missiles, particularly missile technology control regime, but the Chinese always walked around it by calling something, by describing something as maybe 10 kilometers of shorter range than the cutoff in MTCR, etc. So the Chinese gave Pakistan plenty. Pakistan, that's how the Pakistanis stayed quite ahead, and India was having to do catch up. Now that catch up is over simply because the ranges required for Pakistan are not that long. That catch-up is now over and India is now able to focus on the Chinese. Now see how this program is developed. Agni-1 was tested in 1983. That was a very basic missile. Say about range was claimed to be 700 kilometers, but it was more a technology demonstrator. At least that's how we covered it at that point. Agni-2 came up in 1999. This had a longer range, could be 2000 to 2500 kilometer range, which would cover almost one third of China, a Chinese mainland, from some place where it could be based credibly, safely in India. Agni-3 then came up, which was 3500 kilometer range. This was the first of the two-stage missiles in the Agni series. Two-stage means the rocket takes the weapon up or the warlord up, and then after taking it to some distance, propelling it to some distance, one stage falls off. So you have fuel left in the second stage to carry it further. So two-stage rockets, by definition, would travel longer. The rocket fired just now, Agni-5, the latest version, Agni-5 or Divyastra as it's been renamed, that is a three-stage rocket. So that's also a difference. Agni-4 then came up. Agni-4 came up with, again, a claimed 4,000 kilometer range. Again, about one ton of warhead. One ton of warhead doesn't mean it's TNT. One ton of warhead which has a nuclear weapon in it. So it can deliver quite a bit of punch, maybe 20 kilotons, maybe 30 kilotons, depending on how good your warhead making is. This also had another capability. It was also lighter and it could be carried on a mobile launcher. What a mobile launcher does is, it also enhances the safety of your nuclear assets, because the enemy in the course of time will find out where your permanent locations are, because everybody has eyes and ears everywhere, particularly in outer space and in the sky. So they'll pick it up. That's why for a credible deterrence, you also have to have your deterrent in mobility. Ideally in constant mobility, so nobody is able to figure out, zero in and any point of time, nobody should be able to feel confident at any point of time that they've taken out all of your adversaries' nuclear weapon systems. You can take out 99 out of 100, but even if one remains, it will deliver a crippling blow on you, at least a blow that you will not find acceptable. Then came Agni-5. Agni-5, as we told you earlier, the first was tested in 2012. Couple of years ago, in December 22, DRDO also tested the nighttime capabilities of Agni-5. Nighttime is, and missile doesn't bother whether it's daytime or nighttime, but it's the launch where you are launching from. Whatever other factors a nighttime launch and strike involves, that was also tested, because, you know, God forbid, if a country does decide to use a system like this, one, it will be done in a very desperate and difficult situation, weapon of last resort. Second, anybody using nuclear weapons knows that there will be a retaliation. There will be retaliation and there will be massive mutually assured destruction. The last thing you want in such a situation is you firing a weapon and it not working out and it failing. So that's why these tests are so vital. Now, the current lot of work is on a new version of Agni Prime. This Agni Prime is much lighter, I believe. It can also be canisterized, which means it's almost like, it's a bad example. It's an overly simplistic example. It's like on a ship, you bring several goods stored here and there, it used to be the case in the past, or put them all in one container, and then you can take off those containers, put them on a truck or put them on a train and take them anywhere. That is basically what it means to canisterize a missile. A canisterized missile is easier to carry, easier to transport, it's easier to prepare to fire, and can carry its own, a lot of its own launching, aiming, directing, electronics equipment, and the other tamjham with it. That's how it enhances a country's deterrent capability. And the other thing about Agni Prime is, and we'll see as the story unfolds, that unlike other ballistic missiles, it can also be maneuvered mid-flight, right? If it's maneuvered mid-flight, it makes it that much tougher for the defender. Look, if you fire a missile and the defender is able to block it, we've now seen in Ukraine that missiles are not that difficult to block. Almost 85 to 90% of all the missiles fired by the Russians at Ukraine, 85 to 90% have been intercepted at some place. So modern missile interception is very good. And Russians have used some of their best and the fastest missiles, Kinjal, for example. And many of them also get intercepted with Patriot systems, other systems. So missile defense also has improved greatly. What the MIRVING system does is, because you have different warheads going in different directions at different speeds, sometimes you might also program it in such a way that all the warheads come back, take their time, come back and strike the same place. So this is to overwhelm the anti-missile defenses, And when the strike does get delivered, pulverize the defender. That is the idea. In that situation, to have a missile which can be maneuvered mid-flight has its own advantages, because the defender gets to know as soon as you launch a missile. There are no secrets about it. A missile like Agni 5 to reach any credible target in China will take about 20 minutes. That's a lot of time in this business for the defender to prepare and launch their own defense, maybe even launch a counter-strike. In that case, to have the capability of mid-flight maneuverability to avoid any missile defenses also becomes a plus. Now, I told you that deterrence only works if it's credible. See, Russians, they have credible deterrence. At the same time, deterrence is almost never used. That's the reason since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, nuclear weapons have never been used. But when a side has it, sometimes it can be used also. Sometimes it can be used as a hedge, like saying, look, this is my red line. You come beyond it, I might do anything. Or sometimes, like India says, if you use WMDs against me, I will use them against you. But in a disproportionate way, sometimes it can be used for nuclear blackmail as well. The Pakistanis used it as nuclear blackmail with us in India in 1990, summer of 1990, when they said they were going to start a war with a nuclear attack. And that's when India did not have a credible deterrence, and BP Singh's government at that point panicked. That's a story that's been well documented. Books have been written about it. Seymour Hersh has written a very long article about this. That's a confirmed thing. That is something that Mr. Gujral, I.K. Gujral, who was then foreign minister, also confirmed in his memoirs and also in his interviews, because he dealt with it at the Indian end. His warning had come from his Pakistani counterpart, Sahibzada Yaqub Khan. That done, we recently saw, and that's the story that David Sanger broke in the New York Times, we recently saw the Russians use the same nuclear blackmail as well, when through their chatter, etc., electronic chatter, they scared the Americans, they alarmed the Americans sufficiently into believing that they might use a tactical low-strength, tactical nuclear weapon against Ukrainian army concentrations in their ongoing war. This was around time last October when they were really doing badly on the ground, and that was the high point of the Ukrainian armed forces in their defense of their country. And at that point, this story came out. If you read that David Sanger story and the follow-up on CNN, it also says that Joe Biden then reached out to Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi to try and counsel Putin not to do any such thing. But you see, what is the fallout? I'm deliberately using that term. The fallout of this nuclear blackmail is that the Americans have been even more careful not to give the Ukrainians any weapon systems which they could use to strike deeper inside Russia or or with which they could cause such damage to the Russian military effort or Russian installations or Russian assets, that would then again give Putin the excuse or maybe send Putin into panic into using something nuclear. Because what happens is when somebody uses something nuclear, no matter what the strength, there has to be a retaliation. There will be a retaliation. And then you don't know that cycle will take you. So once again, this is a case of nuclear weapons serving as a deterrent, even if in terms of a blackmail.